From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In October, which may seem like eons past, but was just a few months ago, really, we assembled one of our biggest and best New Yorker festivals ever. It was kind of a big to-do because it was the 20th anniversary of the New Yorker Festival, and we pulled out all the stops, with interviews and live performances in venues all over New York and packed houses, if you can imagine such a thing as a packed house. Today on the program, we're going to hear from two of the big stars of that event, Kenan Thompson, the former child actor and now Saturday Night Live veteran, and Hasan Minhaj, the comedian and political commentator. Plus, we'll have a live performance from the singer-songwriter Laura Marling. We'll start with Hasan Minhaj. You could call him one of the many protégés of Jon Stewart. He worked as a correspondent on The Daily Show, and that was a role that blended comedy with pretty serious political analysis. Minhaj launched his own show, Patriot Act, on Netflix in 2018. And in 2 short years, the show won both an Emmy and a Peabody Award. When he spoke with The New Yorker's Carrie Batten last fall, Minhaj had just had something of a viral moment testifying before Congress on the subject of student loans.
Now look, we know the deck is stacked against student borrowers in ways that it wasn't 10 or even 15 years ago. And they deserve some basic protections. Americans should not have to go bankrupt pursuing higher education, and they should never be preyed upon by underregulated loan servicing companies. So members of this committee, we know the government is capable of stepping in during a financial crisis. So really all I'm asking today is, why can't we treat our student borrowers the way we treat our banks? Because 44 million Americans, that is too big to fail. Thank you so much for your time, and I will now go back to where I came from.
Did you show the Maxine Waters reaction?
Maxine Waters' reaction was where she's just like...
She's like, ooh.
Yeah.
It's like a meme now of her like, ooh.
Yeah, it's really good. First of all, how does one get in the position to testify before Congress in this capacity?
I don't know. I thought it was a joke. They were like, we're doing our first hearing about the student loan crisis, and would you like to testify? And I guess that's what you need now on Capitol Hill to get legislation changed. You just got to get a comedian that's available, and they're going to come in and do 5, and hopefully it moves the needle.
Right. And I mean, it's interesting, in this clip, I don't think of you as a troll of a comic, generally. I don't think that's your role, usually.
Okay.
But
thank you.
But you are a little bit in this video. You're pretty confrontational, and I wonder, did you have to psych yourself up for that?
Like, sort of like shadow box in the hallways of Congress.
And just think about kind of like all of these like older people in suits leering at you. And like, that sounds scary.
You know what's really interesting? As soon as I got there, it's pretty sad. Like, Congress is pretty... I thought it was going to be like House of Cards. Like, just like witty banter, amazing lighting, just hot jawlines. It's not like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the DMV. You show up... They're like, here's a Men's Health from 2014 and, you know, some bottled water. And it's pretty much like that. But I just thought it was a bipartisan position. I thought of all the sort of, there's a lot of third rail issues in America. I feel like student loans and student loan borrowers hits constituents in both parties. So I felt like if there was one issue that affects my generation the most and future generations, it was that. Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm.
So I wanna talk a little bit about Patriot Act. This is a show that has such a broad scope and such a high level understanding of world events, but then also such a nitty gritty niche kind of in the weeds way of understanding the world as well. And I would just be curious to hear you talk about the way you consume news and what your media diet is like, and just how do you educate yourself on everything that is going on?
Yeah, I think I'm really lucky. I got my undergrad degree in political comedy at The Daily Show. Like, I was there 4 years. I learned under John, Trevor, Steve Bodo, Jen Flans, like this amazing institution of people that have been there 15 plus years, you know? And they taught me really quick why people turn to our shows. And I realized
people basically turn to our show to synthesize the news and basically summarize it within a one sentence take. Mm-hmm. And generally, whoever had the best take that just makes you laugh out loud, you go with that. That's your act one. And going from that, then I quickly was able to realize, all right, I wanted to be able to do that in longer form storytelling. So I needed to get like a great news team around me. And that started with a really great news producer and then working with junior researchers and fact checkers and sort of just pulling from really, really great, amazing places, the New York Times, AP, Vice. There's all these really amazing journalists that I was following on Twitter that I was a big fan of and just reached out, and we slowly built this team. They would come in and with really great stories, and then the comedy writers would start pitching takes, and we just sort of back and forth.
So I'm going to change gears a little bit. Does your wife think you're funny?
No. No, not at all. No.
Did she think you were funny when you first met her?
No.
No?
No. No, she just keeps it real. Like, I was doing a movie with Kate McKinnon, and she was like, Kate McKinnon is really, really funny. That's funny. And she's right. Like, Kate McKinnon is so undeniably funny.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Your wife is a tough crowd.
She keeps it 1,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So much of your work is about family and about heritage and about parenting in particular.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would love to hear you talk about, you know, what kind of parenting things that you have adopted from your parents that you're kind of coming to understand now that you have your own daughter.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely take a ton of inspiration from, you know, especially my mom and dad, just their work ethic and their hustle. And they just never took anything for granted. Everything, and this can be a good thing, feels like it can go away at any time. So make the most of it. Like, I still have that to this day. I'm not going to show up to set, you know, drunk, high, late, those sort of things. Just, I can feel mom and dad like watching me being like, you're very lucky to do this. They're going to take it away from you if you don't do it right. That desire to sort of overachieve. But I think the biggest difference, and I owe this to them, is their whole thing when they came to this country was surviving. And I feel like my generation, and I hope my daughter's generation, it's about living. And there's a big difference in that. When you're surviving, you sort of placate the status quo. You don't want to ruffle any feathers. You don't tell Ellen, pronounce my name properly. Like, put some respect on it. Mm-hmm. To quote Birdman. Like, yeah. Ummi and Abu would just be like, let Ellen call you whatever she wants. And I'm like, nah, we're not going to do that. We're doing this on daytime. Say Hasan Minhaj. Like, straight up, say my name, Muhammad Ali style. And and that's the difference between surviving and living. And I want my daughter to sort of unapologetically be herself. I want her to be able to talk about her background and what she believes in and what she's about. I just want her to have that audacity.
Mm-hmm. And to know to tell people to pronounce her name correctly.
Yeah. Ava DuVernay wore this super dope shirt. It said, I'm my ancestors' wildest dreams. And mom, dad, you're here. You know, Dadi, if Ummi, if they could see what we're doing, I think about that shirt a lot. Like, I really think about that shirt. That, like, Angrezlo Kisamne, I talk that way. I talk that talk in front of, like, our white bosses. Like, I run my mouth in front of the British. You know what I mean? Like, I think about, like, my grandfather, you know, who isn't here, and, like, how he would feel. And to do it with a level of sophistication and elegance. Don't, like, use crass language or bad language, but to carry myself as if I'm equal, as if I belong just as much as they do. Mm-hmm. And for that to not be like, wow, that's awesome. No, it's like, no, that's the norm. That's the standard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You didn't meet your sister until, how old were you, 8?
Yeah, no. So my sister was born in the States, and then
Oh, okay. She
grew up with my grandparents for a little bit, and then came back when I was around 8 years old.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, does your sister have a different experience? I mean, I should ask her. She's here.
You should ask her. Yeah, yeah. No. Totally. Yeah.
Let's bring her up. No. Yeah. Anyway, well, I won't.
This is like an intervention.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. You know what? Like, she's been really great with me too. Like, checking my perspective. And I remember this was like, we had this really great conversation. You remember this, right after Homecoming King. You were like, that's not the way my experience was with mom or dad. Like, that's not the way I saw the world. Like, you are so melodramatic.
Which parts were?
Just all of it. Yeah. Just like the whole thing from start to finish. What is wrong with you? I've always wanted to actually talk to like Amy Sedaris and David Sedaris about this, of like, hey, is what, like, just, can you adjudicate this, you know?
Sounds like a pitch for Netflix.
I don't know, but you know, it made me realize, like, she was like, that's not the way I saw, my POV of it was and is. And I realized, I was like, this is actually really indicative of a larger conversation in art. A lot of times with art, there's this convo around, what is your writer's room like? What is this like? Why doesn't this show represent what I want it to be? And instead of trying to change Homecoming King, Aisha needs Homecoming Queen. She needs to write her version of that. And you can see the nuances and the beauty and the flaws of that. And I think it really shaped my perspective on the next generation of artists that are starting to make and develop work. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there's a lot of stuff that I see currently in pop culture. If you think that it's missing or there's a gap here, what you need is a platform for people to share their perspective and story, because no one story will be able to encapsulate everybody's perspective.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I love about Patriot Act is how much you talk about the political landscape in India, which I feel like is a subject that Americans are very detached from and they're just willfully do not engage with. I recently saw that photograph of Prime Minister Modi holding hands with Donald Trump in Texas in a stadium. And can you just break down what that entire situation was for this audience? Because it was so confusing to me.
What did you think? What I would love to see is what did you think was going on?
Like it was 45,000 Indian people in Texas in a stadium celebrating the new prime minister who dislikes Muslims, right?
Sure.
And Trump is like, here's a guy who is like the Indian me, so I'm going to run through and and like this is a photo op and that was my
and they're full on holding hands. You nailed it.
Okay.
Yeah. I had to be there. It was just what an interesting combination. You have two fan bases. It's like an Indian Trump rally. You have gun nuts and vegetarians, and it's like you know what I mean? Like, there's one group of people that is like, we cannot put animals in cages. And they're like, you're right. We should only put children in cages.
Yeah.
And it was just merged that day. It was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my life.
And in that episode, in one episode about the Indian elections, you talk about how you had been discouraged by your family and Indian people from talking about their, like, don't talk about it. Why?
It's a third rail issue. How are you going to win this?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you want to talk about India and Pakistan and Kashmir. It's a context that we'll understand here in New York is like Palestine, Israel. How do you want to win this debate? It's filled with like a ton of detail and a ton of nuance and a ton, you know, it's not as simple as what you think it is, and you're going to make a lot of people upset. Either you went too far or you didn't go far enough. But to me, again, like, I want, you know, you don't know how long you have these shows for. I want to use the opportunity that I have to say what I feel and to really just put it out there while I still have the chance to.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to do a little impresario thing and have them pull up a clip of this for anybody who hasn't seen it. It is super funny. Let's take a look.
Hassan, I saw your show on student loan. It was amazing.
I'm actually going to do an episode about the Indian election.
What?
Are you out of your mind?
You're being stupid now.
Indian elections are a definite no-no. There is a lot of garbage outside, and that garbage is going to come on your face if you open your mouth on Indian politics.
You cannot talk about Narendra Modi. You cannot talk about Priyanka Gandhi.
You cannot talk out in the open.
What about on the internet?
Never on internet.
You are an NRI.
You are an ABCD. You're an American-born Desi.
You don't know the Indian politics. It is the world's largest democracy, and I'm going to talk about it.
Politics is like a jalebi, round, you don't know where it ends, where it starts.
Democracy is for people with power, people with muscle power and money power. It is not for you and me.
It's for gangs.
You are going to make millions of people angry.
With the Hindus, with the Muslims, with the Sikhs.
They're going to kill you. You will be no more.
There will be an accident. You will be burned to death. You're gone.
आपको प्रॉब्लम चाहिए?
No, I don't want a problem.
हाँ, तो क्यों करना है?
You can talk about anything else.
Talk about cricket.
Talk about sneakers.
That's more comical.
Did you piss anyone off in your close orbit?
But yeah, yeah, pissed a lot of people off. Yeah. People are very upset.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. But again, look, like for me, I really do believe this. Like, I really admire the journalists that are out there doing really amazing work. And we have an incredible privilege being here in the States. Number one, safety is assumed. And number two, we really do have freedom of speech. Like, yes, there are certain limits to it in certain contexts, but in ways in which journalists in other parts of the world, they don't get to speak this way. And so to me, if you do have that privilege, just be surgical with the way you use it. And to me, this is the opportunity that all the comic friends that I have and the political satirist friends that I have around the world, they don't have those privileges.
Mm-hmm.
So... yeah.
Absolutely. And have you been to India in recent years?
Yeah. I go back and I've done stand-up there and yeah.
What is the audience like for your stand-up sets there?
Well, it depends. So like depending on where you go and like the ticket price, like you're getting a different type of audience. Yeah. And also because there's like Hindi speaking stand-up comedy and then there's English speaking stand-up comedy. Then there's like mixed. And then there's so many different languages and cultures within India. So there's like sub-genres within it too. It's kind of like the way rap is now, where you're like, that person's a rapper, and you're like, yeah, Post Malone is part of hip-hop.
Yeah.
It's like that. You're like, that's a comedian that does it in Telugu? You're like, yeah, he does it in Telugu. That's the Post
Malone. I want to know who the Post Malone of India is.
Yeah.
of Indian comedy.
I don't know, but if a dude had face tattoos, that dude would be wild, because you know his family wouldn't be cool with it. Yeah. That's like a very permanent F you to your parents.
That's a great note to end on. Let's give it up for Austin.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye. Take care.
Hasan Minhaj speaking with staff writer Carrie Batten. Season 6 of Patriot Act is available on Netflix now. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a moment,
we're going to talk about places.
Saturday Night Live's Kenan Thompson.
We're going to talk about fingers.
Stick around.
We're going to talk about faces. We're going to talk about things pertaining to you and you and you and you and you. You too, not you, but you and you. Everybody bang. Ooh-wee. Oh, what up with that? What up with that?
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Kenan Thompson has been in the limelight for going on 30 years, which is a lot for a guy in his early 40s. Thompson was a kid when he broke out on Nickelodeon's All That. He was 25 when he went to Saturday Night Live. And 17 seasons later, he's the longest-running cast member in SNL's history, and somebody who doesn't shy away from appearing in sketches as R. Kelly or Bill Cosby. Kenan Thompson spoke with staff writer Vincent Cunningham at the New Yorker Festival in 2019.
Having broken the record for sort of being on the show, your tenure on the show, I think you're in a better position than anybody in the world to say how much the show has changed. And it just seems like your job is so different now than it was maybe in 03. Like, I feel like people...
say that for probably any comedian, especially in these woke times. It's very touchy out there. And, you have to be very responsible with what you're doing. And, you know, I think Dave did a great job with that.
Yeah. One of the things that I've thought a lot about in terms of how much the show has changed, it used to be that there would be, like, sort of one black cast member that was, like, there to be Richard Pryor or something, you know, there to like play whoever was in the news, you know, then. Uh-huh. And it seems now that you've gotten to this place where you can do like Black Jeopardy and all these things where you can do whole things that are sort of black culture as part of the show in a way that it hasn't been.
Well, these are epic times for America. We've had an African-American president and he served two terms epically, you know?
Yeah.
And Michael Che is, you know, the first black head writer on that show, you know what I'm saying? And these are the times we're living in. So I think it's a fantastic thing. You know, Bowen is our first, you know, Asian American to get on the show. And he happens to be gay as well, so it's like a double up.
I read today that you are the first cast member to be born after the show had already started.
Yeah.
After the 75, I guess, when the show. So, yeah. I mean, it's been around your whole life. Did it mean a lot to you even when you were a kid? Were you watching it?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's SNL. You know what I'm saying? There's been, you know, many imitations since, but it's the mothership. You know what I'm saying? It's like watching Star Trek as opposed to Next Generation. You know what I mean? It's like, it's the real deal. So it just never seemed real for so long. Like, I had such a hard time even associating myself being on the show for a long time. Like, I wouldn't watch, you know what I'm saying? Just because I felt like I was ruining it. You know what I mean? I felt like I was tainting this great, you know, American branded, you know, beloved thing that even my family loved, you know what I'm saying? And now I'm up there kind of just fucking around, and, you know, not taking it as seriously as I needed to or whatever. And I didn't know if I was tarnishing, you know, the image in any kind of way or the reputation in any kind of way, because even I hadn't necessarily proved to myself, you know, what kind of caliber of laughs I was able to get.
How early did you know that you wanted to do all this? I mean, you started pretty early. How did it all start?
I mean, I knew I didn't want to work hard. So,
you seem to have failed at that.
There
I think
was that.
Doing
Man,
stuff. Yeah.
I mean, I like to go to work. I don't like to work hard. I just one of those natural things. I started doing plays and stuff at school. Mm-hmm. And we were doing everything. Piano lessons, sports. You know what I'm saying? It was just a way to stay out the street. But acting was always the one thing that kind of stuck around, you know what I mean? And then once it paid me the first time, I was like, oh, this is definitely it. Because I was cutting grass, you know, for $20 a lawn, non-dependent on how the size of the lawn, you know what I'm saying? So it was just like people were getting over on 10-year-old Kenan, and it wasn't cool. But then, like, a commercial paid me $800, and I was like, yo, that sounds like $8 million. So it lasted for forever. So much candy.
How old were you? What?
I was like 12.
Right.
Yeah.
And a commercial was the first thing you got paid for.
Yes. Yeah. And that was through my teenage years, working through Nickelodeon at the same time and stuff like that. So I got professional at a young age, you know what I'm saying? And I took that very seriously. So
that's strange, being on TV and also being in high school. Like, what?
Yeah, but it was cable, so a lot of them kids weren't really up on it like that. Especially, you know, going to school where I went to school, I don't even know if they had it, you know what I'm saying, like
right.
that. So a lot of kids didn't have Nickelodeon. So I was kind of just, you know, amongst the nerds.
But back to kind of you starting out, I think obviously the stereotype about like people who you think of as child actors is that they like go through this trouble, that there's some like, you know,
yes.
anguish. And like you seem perfect. You seem, I don't know, we're going to find out tonight.
Seriously, would you like a word? Okay.
You seem pretty well adjusted. You just offered somebody some water that
yeah.
you don't know.
I mean,
that's not child actor stuff.
Yeah. It's not like we have to share it.
Well, what was the...
I grew up before social media, so, you know, all my stumblings just weren't reported in the news like that. But now, yeah, I'm also like, I don't come from a family of Barry Moores. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not third generation doing this. Like, I'm, you know, the first one to even get... You know, as far as I've gotten, like, my dad had a singing group when he was in the Army, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that was, like, overseas, and he's always bragging about it, but, like, like show me the record, you know what I'm saying? Like, would love to hear it, as opposed to just hearing about it. I'd love to hear one song, but...
After you had done all that, and you did Kenan and Kel, there was, like, a moment, maybe it was when you started SNL, but was it... Was there a weird transition between being that guy that's known for being young and being sort of a child to sort of move into the more adult phase of your career? Was that a rough transition?
Oh, absolutely. Shall we discuss?
Yes,
Shall
please.
I left Nickelodeon in 2000, so I was chilling. I was feeling very grown, and I was like in the process of buying my first home, and I was like, okay, this is amazing. Like, I'm a settled, you know, established, grown 18-year-old, you know what I'm saying? Like, ready for this, ready to tackle all of this. And then my accountant kind of was a piece of shit. And he took advantage of me as a minor, because when I met him, it was like 15-ish. So right when I first started like making money or whatever. But he was helping my mother out with her taxes. And then, you know, her not really being as savvy, God bless her soul. And I mean, she blames herself and like feels bad about it to this day, so I don't bring it up much. But we went to like Walgreens and got a power of attorney sheet and like gave this dude power of attorney when I was like 15. And yeah, he ran off with my shit. So I was like—
Like everything?
Pretty, I mean, yeah. You could go ahead and just say everything. You know what I'm saying? So I found out about that at the signing for this home that I picked out. And yeah, he was just, you know, a weird, twisted individual. So all those dreams of me like being the king of Atlanta kind of went out the window. And I was like, shit, I got to get back to work. This happened within 2 days. I decided, like, I got to go back to L.A. and, like, get back to it. So I moved back to L.A. with whatever I had left. And just, you know, continued to work. But it was really tough. Like, I was sending my tape to SNL, like, almost immediately. But they were saying, like, I look too young. I look too young. I still kind of do. So I was taking, like, you know, jobs here and there. And, you know, as a working actor, especially when you're young and in between things, things get, you know, kind of spread out. So it was like a job and then 6 months with no job, you know what I'm saying? And then trying to make all that shit work while being kind of famous, you know what I'm saying? So, like, my brakes are squeaking. I'm getting waved at McDonald's, you know what I'm saying? But I get a free chicken sandwich and ain't nobody really tripping. And I just, you know, just kept being able to pay the bills. And did that hustle, you know what I'm saying? Did, like, Love Don't Cost a Thing, and then, like, Felicity, and then Barbershop, and then everything started rolling kind of after Barbershop, because I got the audition for SNL once Tracy left.
Can you tell me how What's Up With That came to be? my favorite sketch in, like, in SNL history.
Thank you. Me too. Yeah. I had an idea. I felt like it would be funny if I had a talk show and didn't let people talk.
Now, often we will see the Oscar winners use their thank you speech to make some kind of a political statement. Now, as a performer yourself, do you think that's appropriate?
Ah, that's a great question. I think it's up to the individual. I mean, you know, giving an Oscar speech is a pretty big platform.
Humongous platform.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of actors have a genuine passion for certain causes.
Passion and action.
I just, you know, I enjoyed, you know, soulful singing and stuff like that, and I felt like it hadn't been on the show like that in a while. And I talked to my buddy Brian Tucker about it, and he was like starting to get it kind of almost immediately. And then, you know, he's good at like writing out four lines, and then we can, you know, kind of mold those lines into, you know, verses that make sense.
Do you write out ooh-wee in the Word doc?
He writes out O-O-O dash W-E-E-E. You know what I mean? So, like, at the table, I do it right. You know what I mean? And then, yeah, What's Up With That? And then one more time, ooh-wee. And then What's Up With That? And that's a chorus. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and you time it out. And then we go from there.
What, I don't know, is one of these more sort of fulfilling for you, creating a new character in a new situation like that, or doing an impression of somebody? Which, are these different parts of the brain, or?
I don't know if it's different parts of the brain. It's definitely people's forte, one or the other, I feel like. I think you're good at impressions, and you're semi-good at character work, or you're really good at character work, and then you're semi-good at impressions. And then, you know, of course, there's some people that can do it all, like Kate McKinnon, you know what I'm saying? But for me, like, impressions come very naturally to me. Like, when I saw Billy Porter yesterday, I was like, oh, I got my next character. You know what I mean? Like, guaranteed, you know what I'm saying? And then,
if you would like to workshop it, please.
It's just one of those things, people just fall out of the sky, especially in New York. Like, Jimmy McMillan was one of those things. Like, I would have never researched, you know, a character that behaved like Jimmy McMillan, you know what I'm saying? But he happened to be a guy that, you know, looked like the Lorax, and talked about the rent being too high. He wore gloves because he was worried about Agent Orange.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you can't make these things up. At least I can't.
One of my favorite impressions of yours that happened in a sketch was, it was kind of, I mean, it's kind of controversial, but it was, you did Bill Cosby in jail.
So what are you in here for?
You don't ask a man that in here. You put your head down. Keep to your business.
Wow, old timer, you really know the ropes. I've never done time before. This friggin' sucks.
Hey! You don't come in here with your filth and your foul, foul filth. You need to get a job.
Hey, Cosby, keep it down. This is the 10th warning and you've only been here 4 days. Lights on!
Wow. Bill Cosby, I mean, on behalf of every one of your fans, it is so disappointing to be meeting you now.
What? I am in my prime. I'm in jail and loving it. No kids with the darndest things. Limited interactions with Camille. And when I was fighting incarceration, I had no idea that one of the staple foods of the prison system is Jell-O.
You've been doing Bill Cosby on some level since you were a kid. Like, you've,
yeah, man.
I've seen you do it forever, and then...
It's one of the more heartbreaking things of my life, I would say.
Yeah.
One, because I was born in 78, so I grew up throughout the 80s, and the Cosby Show, there was nothing bigger, especially in the black household, you know what I'm saying? And he was the first comedian I got to know because he was the clean one. The first book, I think, like the first, you know, autobiographical book that I got was his. Huge fan of Jell-O, you know what I mean? All about it. And on it went, you know, into a different world, you know, picture pages. Like, the guy was everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
And then I get up to a point where I'm able to play Fat Albert, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, oh, that's a huge deal for me, you know,
yeah.
Especially for the culture. So I wanted to do a great job. I couldn't wait to meet my idol. Got to meet him first day. Got to work with him, you know, a couple weeks later or whatever, and it was a cameo with just me and him. And was a little exposed to kind of like his real nature as opposed to like his, you know, persona that he puts on, and it was a little raw. So it wasn't as raw as what really came out, but yeah. It was definitely a peek behind the curtain of like, oh, this is not just Mr. Clean or whatever. It was never anything like overly alarming where I was just like, you know, police, I think you guys need to check this dude out. But, you know, it was, you know, I just had never heard him even curse, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, like, hearing him just talk casually and stuff like that was, you know, shocking. And then, yeah, it all blew up after that. And when it all came crashing down, it was like, that's crazy. But it doesn't eliminate what my job is. And my job is to hold the mirror up to what life is. Same reason why, you know, we had to do the OJ thing. There was a guy named OJ who's out of jail and dating, you know what I'm saying? It's just the reality.
He's on Twitter right now.
It's not cool. I would rather he didn't. But, you know, that's the times.
Yeah. On that happy note, thank you for doing this, man.
Oh, my pleasure, man.
Kenan Thompson, speaking with staff writer Vincent Cunningham in October 2019. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today's program brings you interviews from the New Yorker Festival. It's something of a tradition at the festival that my colleague John Seabrook will interview one of the most interesting songwriters or pop musicians that's working out there today, and we always get to hear a little music. Laura Marling released her first album when she was 18 years old, but it didn't really feel like the work of someone who had just earned the right to vote. Marling is 30 now, and she's got 7 albums under her belt. The most recent just came out in April, and it's called Song for Our Daughter.
Though they may want you to tread in their trail, only to see if the path they set fails. Though they may want you to take off your clothes.
Marling's particular brand of dense but delicate folk music has earned her the acclaim of so many critics, and she's got a lot of passionate fans like John Seabrook. She and Seabrook spoke at the New Yorker Festival in 2017.
In my work, I meet quite a few artists that are very good singers. Some of those artists are also good players. And a few of those artists are also good songwriters. But I never meet someone who is as good as you are at each of those categories, any one of which would probably make you a very successful artist. So you're a real artist. Welcome. You're fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks.
And Laura and I actually know each other. We met a couple years ago. We played Boggle together. But anyway, so Laura, that was in April of 2015. Talk about what you were doing in California those years. You had 3-4 great albums, and then you left Britain and went to California. Why?
I was touring by myself. So after my fourth record, which was Once I Was an Eagle,
right,
I had been touring with a band for 8 years, I guess, or 7 years, and I was tired of that.
Yeah.
So I decided to go and tour the States just on my own.
I read something you said interesting. You said that because you started so young, and when you start touring and when you go out, your sort of emotional development is sort of arrested by the nature of touring.
Yeah.
It's hard to develop as a person. And what, can you talk a little about, what is it about touring that kind of arrests you in terms of development?
Well, you basically employ someone to be your parent, you know, full-time carer.
That's your tour manager?
Yeah. It's a really thankless job. But yeah, you know, you are given a schedule every day. You're told where to shower and at what time.
Right.
And it's very limiting. And it's very claustrophobic. It can be. If your mindset begins to make it that way,
right,
it becomes sort of terrifyingly claustrophobic.
And that was part of what drove you to California, that wanting to get out of that cycle?
Yeah. Well, I did the tour of the States and it was, you know, magical and I had a lot of adventures. And then I just landed in LA, not somewhere I had ever even sort of romanticized in my head.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I landed there and I stayed there. And I found that really, from the claustrophobic mindset that I was in, LA was kind of perfect.
I mean, the other thing about California with you, and we were talking a little about this earlier, Laura had a father who loved 60s singer-songwriters, in particular, Neil Young. And one of your very first songs that he taught you was The Needle and the Damage Done, which I think you later recorded with Jack White.
Yeah.
It's a really great version, by the way. But I think on the Joni Mitchell, he actually had you sit and listen as a very young person to Joni Mitchell, right?
Yeah.
And I was asking you earlier, do you think he kind of wanted to make you into Joni Mitchell?
It's creepy to think that maybe he did.
Because maybe it worked.
Yeah.
But anyway, can you talk a little bit about having a father who was a record producer who influenced you musically?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was saying earlier, I think Joni Mitchell was the only female songwriter he could think to put in front of me.
Have you felt like Joni Mitchell has become a musical touchstone for you? I mean, your voice in that middle range, up and down, sounds somewhat like Joni Mitchell.
Wow, that's very kind.
I mean, and you're a brilliant songwriter like Joni Mitchell, and you're blonde.
And I'm a lady.
And you're a lady.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah.
But, and then you went to California.
And then I went to California.
So I guess that's what I was thinking of. Like, yeah. Wasn't that part of your California trip? Just to maybe reckon with some of these archetypes that you kind of grew up with? Or?
Yeah, someone was asking me the other day whether I lived in Laurel Canyon when I was there. And I was like, no, you can't afford to live in Laurel Canyon. Are you kidding me?
Right.
But so as soon as I got there, all of that mysticism was gone. Mm. Do you know what I mean? But there are still there is this mystical thing in LA that the old school guys and girls are there. You know, you feel that they're there in the hills looking down on the city, and you hear about, you know, because most of my friends are musicians and they, you know, talk about playing with Jackson Browne at the weekend or, you know.
They're like the old fathers up there.
Yeah.
David Crosby up there.
David Crosby, of course.
Like a Buddha.
Yeah.
That's John Seabrook talking with Laura Marling at the New Yorker Festival in 2017. And here's Laura Marling playing Daisy off her album Short Movie.
Daisy lives by the docks, down at the White Rocks, running an open home. Daisy lives by the sea. I only see Daisy when she wants to see me. Daisy's all right, she's up all night, down at the docks, running an open home. I think that you look at her wrong. I think that you look at her so wrong. Woman alone is not a woman undone. Daisy met a man from Sicily, sailed in one day and told her who she was gonna be. Oh, did he look at her stage? For no one and nobody is Daisy gonna change. Daisy's alright, she's up all night, down at the docks in an open home. I think that you look at her wrong. I think that you look at her so wrong. Woman alone is not a woman got a baby now. She called her Angelina, so she stand out of the crowd. Daisy doesn't care from where she sees. As far as we're concerned, she is immaculately conceived. Daisy's alright, she's up all night, down at the docks, running an open home. I think that you look good. That you look at her so wrong. Woman alone is not a woman undone.
That's Laura Marling performing at the New Yorker Festival in 2017. Her new album is called Song for Our Daughter. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and before we go, one more song from Laura Marling. It's called Wild Once.
If you grow up listening to a lot of Joni Mitchell, then you end up having a lot of guitar tunings, which is what's happening there. They put my hands in water.
told me I'm a god. I might be someone's daughter, I might be somewhat odd. But I was wild once, and I can't forget it. I was wild, chasing stones. The martyr who feels the fire, and the child who knows his name. They remember that there's something wild, and it's something you can't explain. And it's something they can't explain. They are wild and they can't forget it. They are wild, chasing stones. It's hard if you can't change it. It's worse if you don't try. Sit down to explain it and be constantly asking why. You are constantly asking why. Well, you are wild and you must remember. You are wild, chasing stones. That getting tired and familiar long. You must change what hangs here. Give me something to go on. Give me something to go on. You are wild and I won't forget it. You are wild, chasing stones.
That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. I'm David Remnick. I want to thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with help from Rhonda Sherman and David Ohana. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.